Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. Sitting here reading, and I get this text message, and it says, "Wake up!" And I look, and I'm like, "Oh shit!" And let me tell you what had my attention. Listen to this shit. This is how crazy my life is, right? So, my co-author, Stacy, I shot her an email, and then I get this, and then I get my phone beckoning me back, right? Come look at us so we can monetize your dumb ass, because that's what phones do, right? And LinkedIn was beckoning me. And LinkedIn said 5 people have viewed your profile. So, I said, well, I thought to myself, that's interesting. I always want to see who's looking at my profile. And the executive director at Mayo Clinic looked at my profile. What? How about that? And that's all they say. They don't give a name. There's a chief executive officer at Mayo. We have 2 connections. Neither one of them. I mean, they're just people on LinkedIn, right? If you're familiar with LinkedIn and how it works. So when you do this, like who's viewed you and things like that. If they don't want to be known, they view you on like a company account. And so it says executive director at Mayo Clinic. So I click on that and there's all these different people. And I'm looking for people that I have common connections with that would have any reason. I don't see anybody that would be a reason for them to be looking at my shit. Yeah, so I was doing that, and all of a sudden it says, I get this text message, wake up. Waking up normally not a problem for me, just for the record. Being preoccupied is. So I apologize for being preoccupied. The Mensa sisters are going to join me here in a few minutes. Yeah, in about 6 minutes they will join me, and we will we'll seek to entertain you for about an hour, and then they will be dismissed to go about their day. And I have some errands to run. And then in preparation, I think, like most people, of spending a not very happening New Year's Eve. Yeah. And right? I think I speak for everybody. Well, you know, I have mixed feelings about 2020. I mean, it was different for me. I didn't lose anybody close to me because of COVID, so knock on wood. And I had, you know, post-traumatic winning continued to do great things. So I, you know, Personally, it was not a whole lot of fun, as I think post-traumatic winning obviously would have grown more had it, this thing not been around. But the people I've met, the things that have happened have been life-changing. And, you know, I said, you know, I've said this week that this past Christmas might be the best Christmas I've ever had. And I don't want to offend my kids or anything like that, but, you know, the magic of Christmas and seeing, you know, the incredible look that little kids have on their face. I mean, it's always, you don't get over that as a parent. You know, they come around the corner and they see the tree all lit up and all the presents underneath it, or not some years. And they just get that look on their face. Oh my God, Santa came. And so, so that's always special. But having said that, when you have the words, I was going to kill myself this weekend, but I'm not because of what you said. When you have that echoing in your ear, how can Christmas not just be absolutely incredible? And So the other cool thing about my Christmas was people who I've crossed paths with and impacted their life have checked in throughout the whole Christmas, right? What's up, motherfucker? Yeah, that's how they check in. I'm like, how are you? But you know what? To hear that in some of those voices is absolute total winning. And so, what do I say? Good on top of good on top of good on top of good on top of good. Yeah, that's how that goes. So, so pretty cool stuff. Pretty cool stuff. So let me fire up the national anthem. Good morning to you. The Mensa sisters will be here shortly. And this is dedicated to the proposition that I like. You know what? I like saying that. In case you haven't noticed, I say that a lot. Right? That phrase is in the Gettysburg Address. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men were created equal. Dedicated to the proposition. I like that. Well done, Mr. President. Can you believe Lincoln is now being canceled? It's amazing. I will tell you this. So all this shit will run its course. And at some point, it will stop. And the pendulum will swing back and to center where it belongs. Because people aren't stupid, and somehow these idiots have got elected, and by their actions, they will unelect themselves. So, with that said, this is dedicated to 2020 being one of the great bounce-back years of American history. Everybody knows the human capital resident in Americans, and so we'll see that on display in 2021. let's just hope enough small businesses can weather the storm and see that light of day. So to that proposition, this is dedicated.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore. So, young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day. And Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, we'll check the weather. And then two of the three Mensa sisters are here. Jeff Kenny is portraying Kim Lynch this morning, and he's not around. So he will figure that out shortly. Currently, it is partly sunny and 50 in Quantico. It is cloudy and 70 down the coast at Camp Lejeune. It is sunny and 47 in 29 Palms, so cold out there. It is cloudy and 46 at Camp Pendleton. Camp Smith in Hawaii, where I've never been, is dark, cloudy, and 75, so warmed up in Hawaii. In Okinawa, it's in the 50s in Okinawa. Exactly. Dark, cloudy, 54 in Okinawa, and in Darwin, where it's always hot, it's 81, dark and cloudy in Darwin. Never been there either. Tim's been to Australia. In Oslo, which is in Norway, don't you know, it is cloudy and 32. At the home of All Marine Radio, it is partly sunny and 52. Looking for a high today all the way up to 64, 67. On Friday, 63 on Saturday, 63 on Sunday, 62 on Monday. I'm not sure we'll have a show on Monday. I haven't decided yet. Yeah, I might extend my holiday. So, with that said, joining me from the Empire State of New York is William Constant Weenie. Do you remember the first? Has that been a constant name for you growing up? I mean, that's not a hard thing to come up. No, it wasn't, because I remember I was thinking about this the other day, and I remember doing something at the basic school. We're out AI-ing, and you know, the lieutenants are all, you know, kind of milling about and getting organized, and somebody said, who's your AI? And one of them said, Constant Weenie. And I started laughing, and I said, what did you say? And they got like scared, like I was going to jack them up, but I thought it was funny. Like, oh, sir, that's our nickname for... you showed up as a first lieutenant, right, Will?
I did.
Right. For I think it was, they said
it was shocking to me to go from Lima Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines, to the basic school, and wondering what Marine Corps about half of the staff had served in.
Oh my!
Because it sure wasn't the one I had been in. Dave Bice and Rusty Blackman, you know, me and Jeff were in the same company with a couple other really hard-nosed guys. And I tell people, Lima Company 3 probably was not the best unit I was ever in, but it was, man for man, it was the hardest unit I've ever been in, and very no-nonsense.
Explain hard.
Physically, put your gear here on Monday afternoon, 15 miles down to LZ Cardinal, cross country moves all night, hump back Thursday afternoon, battalion hike 15 or 20 miles on Friday, rinse, repeat. Guy falls out of a hike, and I'm the company XO, and you see Marines spit and kick people because they've had enough of carrying their gear, you know. Carry your own gear or move out somewhere else, maybe Kilo Company. It was a tough, tough unit. You know, it was in the squad bays at Geiger for most of that time. And there's a very different lifestyle when Marines are living in squad bays. And some real hard-nosed company gunnies in particular, first sergeants, And not in a negative way. I mean, some of these guys, I saw mentoring like it's supposed to be. They had an expectation that you were going to be a man. And they held Marines for that. But they were definite servant leader types. So really, really... a unit that I tried to emulate many times in many ways throughout my time. But I got to tell you, when I went to the basic school, a big chunk of that staff would never have survived Lima Company 3-8. So,
yeah, you know, teaching the concepts of thinking and stuff like that became, for some guys, I don't think who grew up like we grew up, was kind of mutually exclusive with good order and discipline, attention to detail, being good in your craft and things like that, you know? And so it was interesting as you kind of learned and you watched different guys teach and what they emphasized. Don't try to get away from the nickname though. The nickname was, it was quality nickname.
Guy like Jeff. Look at a guy like Jeff.
Right.
You know, smart as anybody you, and pound for pound, you know, one of the all-time tough guys.
No, I mean, and that honestly, that was the fun about our experience. And I don't know. I met Will when you first got there. I was in tactics, and then when I went to IOC, you know, you were a captain. You were, you know what. You went down to be the CO of EI Company, or you were the XO first and then the CO?
No, CO.
Right. And so, but, you know, and so Will wrote his own schedule. So, you know, he would come out and check out his guys at IOC. So I probably saw him more when we were at IOC. But, you know, the guys at IOC, they tended to be that group, right? Which is think it and perform it. Not just one or the other. And again, you would have guys at the basic school that were screamers, and all they screamed about was, you know, your yoke stick for your defensive position, your camouflage, but they couldn't teach you how to think and how to teach all the things you have to teach. They couldn't play the range of military instructors that you had to play, I think that any good instructor plays. And you know, it started with just the basic continuing actions that Marines have to do and that you got to emphasize all the time. And a lot of guys, as Will says, that was too much of a pain in the ass.
Hey, you know the first time I was impressed with Tim Lynch?
When?
So Tim got there as a lieutenant and was a platoon commander for the warrant officer course. Right. And when he had that collection of misfit toys outrunning to standard, you know, out 3 mile run road back and back, I was like, this guy's a little bit different. Usually we sort of take it easy on those warrant officers. This guy's going to just hold people to standard. Said, we may actually have something here. So that's when I was first impressed with Tim.
Nice. And joining us, speaking of him, joining us from McAllen, Texas, Tim Lynch. Tim, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing just great. Thanks. How are you guys?
We're good. Do you remember the first time you heard the nickname Constant Weenie?
No, I don't specifically, but I'll tell you what I do remember. I remember the change in responsiveness from EI Company from before Will went down there till after, because that changed things quite significantly for us. It made being in the field fucking easy. Remember?
You know what? I'm Lenny Etcho was down there before you, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so listen, Lenny took over.
Yeah.
A disaster.
Yeah. That's what I remember.
And those guys, they had gone over the cliff and Lenny basically grabbed them and brought them back up to the edge of the cliff.
If you want to if you want to meet a meat and potatoes guy, Leonard Etcho.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lenny had this head
that
had two hemispheres. And they weren't like space, like they were vertical, right? Not horizontal hemisphere. So he had this head that had like a valley in the middle of it, right? So he had the front globe and I don't know what happened. He liked to smoke, and Lenny is about an everyday man as you would ever meet, but he is whip smart, right? And he talks like every Joe Schmo on the planet. And he'd be standing there smoking a cigarette, and he'd be talking to Joe Schmo, and then he'd go Clausewitzian on you and link like three concepts together, and you'd be like, holy shit, man. But he was specifically sent down there before Will got there because it was a disaster. And I remember thinking, when you said that, Tim, I remember thinking that there's more to that story.
No, you're right. I forgot the progression, but it was. But prior to Lenny and Will taking over, dude, it was very difficult sometimes.
Well, let me tell you that's a tough. That's not an easy. I mean, guys, O3s roll into Quantico, right? Infantry Marines, they roll into Quantico, and they're like, "Yeah, we're gonna be instructors. We're gonna do this. We're gonna do that." And they reported to the EI Company, and they, you know, they like, "Here's your check-in sheet, man. Go get your stuff. You got to go to the field tonight." I mean, and then they're in the field constantly at the base of school. That is not, I mean, how, well, first of all, let me say hi to Jeff, and then we'll get back to EI Company. Jeffrey, how are you?
Good, yeah, and I got a little experience in the EI Company. So
yeah.
It was good time. Yeah.
Well, as you followed Will in your career, nightingaling off his career. So Will, explain EI Company and the challenges of, I mean, the op tempo there, I mean, is substantial.
Yeah, so it's about 200, and at that time, 60 Marines. About 35 of them were in the engineer platoon. The rest were all O3s. And all the guys who were there on their first enlistment, that's the only thing they did in the Marine Corps. So they joined the Marine Corps to see the world, go to exotic places, et cetera, and they ended up in Quantico either being slave labor or a training aide. And no matter what they did, they could never accomplish their mission, right? Because lieutenants kept showing up. So they could never accomplish their mission. And their mission sort of sucked. It was load trucks, unload trucks, stand there as lieutenants, you know, shoot weapons, die in place for them. They had significant problems. And it was also overtasked. On any given day, we needed, you know, 325 Marines. And then, since they were the only infantry Marines in the National Capital Region, with the exception of 8th and I, you name the dog and pony show, someone thought it would be a good idea to send Marines from EI Company out to it. So we'd be in the field 3 or 4 days a week, and then they'd be doing a static display at some, you know, 4-H fair over the weekend. And, you know, 250 Marines, and we had 15 guys that had been to level 3 inpatient alcohol treatment, I think. We had about 10 guys on antabuse. We had 9 DUIs in the first 7 weeks we were there. And so, you know, and the worst part about it is, you know who got in my ass about that? No one. No one.
Yeah.
Nobody cared about it. And so, you know, Jeff showed up probably a week or so after I took command, I think, or maybe yeah. right before I did.
Well, but you got me there, man. That was a great favor of it. I mean, Will got me to the basic school by going to the XO of the basic school and saying, hey, we want this guy. So I was originally supposed to go to Camp David, but that didn't work out. And then and it didn't work out because Craig Tucker wanted to bring me up there, but the rule is you can't have the CO and the XO of the guys at Camp David be on the same rotation. They got to be like staggered.
Right.
So, but Will, when he heard that, I said, hey, I'd like to come up there where you guys are. You know, he got me up there by going to the XO. And then he got me down to EI Company, which was fantastic because everything, like he said, you know, but also the fact was, and I don't know if he did this on purpose.
Of course.
You never know, Will, you know, but he.
Of course he did. Come on.
And Will right away made priorities that didn't exist before. First priority, these are infantry guys. First priority is the infantry officer's course. And then the second priority is, you know, the lieutenants going through, you know, the BOC. And so consequently, I was weapons platoon, so a lot of live fire. All of it was honchoed by my guys. And there's actual teaching going on when it comes to, you know, the plotting boards for the mortar training, and then the nitinoid stuff dealing with the, you know, machine guns and so forth. So, you know, it was a great precursor. It was a great way to end my time in the fleet because that was rewarding too. And then that was good. And I have to say, I hate to admit, but fucking Will was responsible for all of it.
Wow.
And not only that,
there's to being a Nightingale.
I didn't think this was going to go in this direction. Had I thought that, we would never go down this dark trail.
One more thing, though, about that. What we used as a morale builder for EI Company was every year there was like a short company or two, and they couldn't divide and effectively fight each other in the climactic, you know, tactical training of the BOC, which was the war. So EI Company would fight as a company. We did it twice while I was there with Will. And it was great force on force because the other guy on the other side was also a seasoned BOC instructor, you know, and so it was good force on force. And the good thing about it was we were like the U.S. Army during the Revolution. We started out kind of weak because it started at the end of the training week. And then we got strong on Saturday and Sunday because all our guys didn't have any commitments those days for the BOC. And then we started getting weak again. We're down to like, so our strength would be like 220 guys on Saturday and Sunday dominating the lieutenants. Because Will kicked ass on both the other guys, you know, the other company commanders. And then near the end, we'd be a desperate struggle to survive. Climacting with us being overrun off the application trail in that punitive Yankee D that some, I think Tim had his guys dig, that we ended up in there.
That was a good defense.
You know, I want to go back to Will's comment, and nobody cared. Well, let me ask you to explain that, because was it that nobody cared or everybody knew what a difficult job that was and they gave you your space?
Well, no, So, gee, that's great that people would pat me on the head, but no one cared about those Marines. Yeah. 9 DUIs in 7 weeks, you know, a dozen guys on antabuse, somewhere north of 15 people have been to level 3.
Explain to everybody what antabuse is.
It's a drug you take that when you drink alcohol, it makes you vomit. So it's a preventive.
Yeah. That's how we do that.
And, you know, one of our one of our watchwords in the company became is that these are Marines. Because people always treat them as EIs. And this, no, these are Marines. You treat them like Marines. And there's a lot to that. So, for example, when we would go to the field, and at the end of the field problem, the trucks would show up and lieutenants would hop on the trucks and the enlisted Marines would sit in the LZ and then the trucks would come back and pick them up. And I said, no, these are Marines. Enlisted Marines go first. Oh, well, you know, lieutenants, they got to get to chowning. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Right? We send our enlisted, we teach officers that officers eat last. And if lieutenants are up late cleaning weapons because of truck rotation, right? We also have expectations of these men that the enlisted Marines there, because they didn't have a relationship with the lieutenants, could very often do things that an enlisted Marine would not do in Lima Company 3-8. Uh-huh. You know, and the idea is that you talk to a lieutenant the way you talk to me. We hold you to a standard. And we got some benefits. You know, that was the summer of 1991. So we started getting guys that had been in the Gulf War. And we got an influx of NCOs and staff NCOs that had just spent 7 or 8 months doing nothing but training. And we're very, very, very technically proficient. So that helped us. But just an attitude to try and teach people at the basic school. Look, one of my alcohol abuse prevention tools was to run the company on Monday morning. And we used to run 6 miles, and there'd be a trail of tears up, you know, 3 mile run road to the FBI Academy and back. And people say, hey, this ain't the fleet. You can't PT those guys like that. I said, well, this is the Marine Corps. But the pushback I got from people at the basic school that you were taking a company out to do company PT showed you people, and it was a bizarre place. They didn't care.
Wow.
They didn't care enough to hold people accountable, but also to hold themselves accountable as leaders. And as a very junior captain, it was an unnerving experience at times to see how we were willing to violate all the leadership we'd ever learned in order to make this basic school system run in an economic the way we made it run. Like I said, who joins the Marine Corps to spend 3.5 years in Quantico? We should be rotating these guys out. Right. They should get to a battalion in time to make a deployment. That'd be really expensive. Yeah. You fucked this guy. You recruited him to a certain thing, and now you're never going to give it to him.
Right.
And you wonder why people get off the reservation. It's easy for me to see why.
Right.
It'd be expensive. No, it wouldn't. It's actually the right thing to do.
When you look at it,
it's cheap.
Yeah, when you look at the reenlistment rates, right?
Yeah, it was zero.
Yeah, zero, zero. I want. This kind of opens up a dark door. We'll talk about somebody not caring. I'm going to share and jog, you know, a memory. The day that helicopter crashed inside my assembly area. Okay, so my company's out at Wood Canyon. Out in 29 Palms, you're getting ready to do a 10-day operation, I plan, and this helicopter crashes inside the fucking assembly area. And so we're in this kind of, I call it a 360, but it's really a kind of a rectangle where this dried-out riverbed opens up into a corridor, a desert corridor with mountains on both sides, right? So this riverbed with, you know, kind of sides on it, sloping into the wadi, which is a dry-out riverbed. So we're in the crevices of the sides of this thing, vehicles backed in, cami nets down, hard to kill, all that shit, right? So this thing crashes in the middle of that, inside of that, which is crazy to think of, okay? Nobody from the battalion, nobody from the regiment, nobody from McCaxey came out to see what happened. Nobody. And I remember a week or after the after we did all the stuff we did that day, you know, and then we sat on the site waiting for Mag 39 to come out so nobody would disturb it so they could begin their survey, and then I think we had to stay there for another day before they started hauling. They completed the physical survey of all the parts and everything and the wreckage and the photography, and then began to truck the wreckage out. And so we do our thing. We come back, and I'm at church. So it'd probably be, you know, 10 days later, I'm at church, and I'm a Catholic. Susan, I, and John and Patrick are there. And Bob Neller, Lieutenant Colonel type, who was my battalion commander, and then was the regimental XO at the time. Colonel Bedard was the CO. And he sees me outside. He sees me at church, and as we walk outside, he's waiting for me. And he motions me to come over to him because his wife Darcy's with him. So Darcy and Susan know each other, right? So they're talking, and so he says, "Come here." And he looks at me and goes, he said, "How are you?" And again, my introduction into mental health, right? I get tears in my eyes. And I looked at him and I said, "I'm fucking pissed. That's how I fucking am, sir." And he looks at me and goes, "Why?" I said, "You know, I don't need anybody to hold my hand or wipe my fucking ass. But you know the message that got sent to my Marines? When they saw one guy decapitated, tried to save three other dudes, everybody fucking dies inside our assembly area, and not one motherfucking leader from my battalion or from the regiment or from the combat center comes out to see, hey, Marines, how you guys doing?" And he just looked at me, you know, like he had seen a ghost. And he said, "I heard it, and I grabbed my helmet, but I didn't want to step on his toes because I had just given the battalion up, and I thought it would be, you know." And he looked at me, he said, "Nobody." I said, "Not the OPSO, not the XO, not the Sergeant Major, not my CO, not you, not Bedard, fucking nobody." And he just looked at me and said, "I'm sorry." He said, "I'll never do that again." And so, I mean, I can't even conceive of that now. I mean, that Amtrak went down off the coast, and you had the Commandant of the Marine Corps making statements along with the MEF CG and the Division CG and everybody. And I thought of it that day too. So I fucked this up. So Jeffrey, you're gonna go last. So because you can't copy anybody with this, okay?
I never copy anybody. I'm an original man.
Now that I think about it, Timmy, how about somebody who just didn't give a shit as a leader? You don't need to name them personally, but if you want to give the episode.
Well, I think back to the one suicide I dealt with. Again, that was a sergeant coming out to the field during our McCress who was scheduled to leave the hospital. I didn't know what kind of appointment he had. I wasn't quite too sure. I knew he was involved in some counseling. It's all we knew. And he came back, checked out his rifle, but then drove home. We didn't know anything was afoot until my supply guy came back and said, "Hey, the sergeant went there to pick up." And I called the armory and they said, "Yeah, he drew his weapon." And that's when we got word and we at least were smart enough to call the police and go to his house, and he had shot himself. I don't recall anybody being excited about it other than the fact of making sure that the chain of custody of the rifle was accounted for. And did we have written procedures about how we issue weapons when people were going to the field, which we didn't, but it wasn't a big deal. I didn't know enough. I didn't know enough to say anything else to the rest of the platoon or whatnot. I don't recall anybody talking about it. We went out and we went and buried him at Riverside, and that was it. And nobody ever mentioned it again. And I don't think that was probably the right way to handle that particular incident.
Jeff, how about you?
Well, I have to say, it's kind of like it's where you're torn. You know what I mean? Because I didn't have that experience like you had there with that, you know, that helicopter crash in your with your company and everything. When we had guys die, and it happened sometimes, we had a lot of command attention. And I have to tell you, though, my sense was the command attention was trying to protect the Marine Corps, air quotes, so, by punishing somebody pretty rapidly, you know? So after Will left, I became the XO of that company. And after about 7 months getting ready for another float, which turned into the Desert Shield Liberia float, part one, we were doing a family day out there by Hospital Point, and we had a kid drown. Two Marines went into the water. They're on a rented canoe that they got from the marina. And I saw them in distress from the beach, and they went in. So I got one of the lieutenants, Jim Ferris, and him and I went down the marina. We got the marina, civilian OIC, and he took us out there in a motorboat. And here's this canoe with a female in it, with a wife, one of the guys. And she's sitting there like in a daze, and there's sandals floating in the water. These two guys went in, they're under the water. So I didn't know what to do. So I jumped in, and by pure luck, I feel a slimy, arm. You know, it was, I don't know if that water off of, in the New River off of Hospital Point is nothing. You can't see anything, you know? So we got this one guy out, and I couldn't find the other guy. And Will, you might remember, is Corporal Strickle from 1st Platoon. He drowned. We didn't find his body for 3 days. But there's a lot of people that are looking, but they're looking to, they're trying to see, they're trying to blame somebody for the fact that anybody could get out and rent a canoe, you know what I mean? But they're like, they're after my company commander who succeeded Captain Ratliff, who was the company commander Will and I had, the guy after him. He managed to survive it, but man, they were after him. So, I mean, I think we're talking about two sides of the same ugly coin that sometimes is present in the Marine Corps of careerism, you know? So nobody came to see you. And I know who your battalion commander was, and he perished on Highway 62, I guess 10 or so years later in 2002, when he was the Coyote 6. I mean, it's ironic, but, the first thing the Marine Corps does, like any other big organization, is protect itself. And you see it time and time again across the board in a lot of different, venues and everything, how a bureaucracy will close ranks to protect itself. Obviously, what your situation that happened, Mac, it was not perceived as a danger. I mean, I can't see how, guys get killed in a helicopter because of a helicopter accident.
Well, I've gone through that in my head.
Right.
So the OPSO comes in like, hey, sir, you need to know about this. A Huey crash that was supporting, Alpha Company. They took that air defense variant with him, right? Mac briefed us on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it went down while it was aggressing the company. Where'd it go down? Well, it went down inside the assembly area. What? Right? End of story, yeah. Right? Grab my helmet, get my driver, I'm out. Like,
yeah.
Or if I can't go, you've got to go. Or Sergeant Major Lynch has to go, but like what? I can't fathom how the fuck that happens. And I'm not going to say the guy's name, but I remember being, I think it was Iraq, and somebody was talking about him, and they said, "Well, Mac, you must have worked for him," and. And I didn't say very many nice things. And he had already died, right?
Right.
And they looked at me like with jaws hanging open, right? And I said, I'm sorry. That's where I fucking feel, man. And so I've struggled with it over the years, and I try to understand how nobody could go out there. Not even the fucking chaplain. The chaplain came out late in the day. He was the only person that came out to tell me that the other three guys had died. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, Mac, Jeff brings up a really good point that the institution protects itself, but it's not that hard to do both. I was in a unique situation.
Fucking boom, Will. Fucking boom. I mean, Will, how many times did you get called up to anybody's office to talk about these issues? What more can we do? How do we mitigate that? How many times did anybody that you reported you call you in and say, how do we do this better?
Uh, I'm not sure that that happened a lot. But I'll tell you, as a battalion commander, I was in a very unique situation in that I had people deployed and we had just come home. And so me and my sergeant major, we lost 4 Marines killed in action while we were home and they were deployed. And we went to those funerals and I told the sergeant major, we're going there for 2 reasons. Number one is we need to make sure that the Marine Corps does the right thing by these families. We need to take care of these families. Right. And number two is we need to make sure that the families know that the Marine Corps took care of them, right? We're protecting the family, but we're also protecting the institution.
Right.
We owe it to the Commandant to make sure that his Marine Corps does it right and to make sure that people know we did it right.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think it is bizarre to me that you have command responsibility and don't go to see. And I think that there's a lot of people that did spectating, post-incident spectating in Iraq that were not value added.
Oh, shit.
But I got to tell you something, as a battalion commander, when we lost guys or had them wounded, I went to every one of those places and I found that between me, my sergeant major, my gunner, the staff sergeant who used to run around as sort of my bodyguard, the Australian warrant officer who ran my jump platoon, we would always learn something of value by being there and seeing. And not to chew someone's ass because they didn't do something, but we were doing that disaggregated operation. And so if Alpha Company had had something, we wanted to pull it apart and learn from it, figure it out so that we could go pass that down to Delta Company, because Delta Company was 147 miles away. So I found that you provided value. And you also reinforce with people, look, shit happens. It's not all your fault.
Right.
Sometimes shit happens.
Well, I think that's after watching Dunford, Kelly, and Mattis while I was Mattis's staff sec. I mean, when a good leader shows up, you know, and they sit down with you and they kind of descend on you, right? Whether it was General Mattis and, you know, Sergeant Major Bell or and then the division gunner that you know would roll with them. I mean, those guys were experienced, you know, savvy guys.
They were not helpful.
Well, so again,
when Dunford showed up, you were happy, right? Because you learned something,
right? I know, but
when Mattis showed up, you were just getting the microscope shoved up.
Not everybody had your experience, okay? But and my point is this, point well made. Well, I acknowledge that. Most of the time, that buttressed people, because I can remember going with General Kelly out to Husseiba after 3-7 got in that big, you know, fight where they cleared the city, and they had a huge fight out there, and Captain Maloney was killed, I believe, out there, right?
He got killed in Ramadi working for
no 1-5. Who's Gannon was killed out by Husseiba. And so, we went out there. I met Trent Gibson out there. One of his guys, while we're getting ready to leave with General Kelly, has a negligent discharge of a saw while he's on post. Not good timing. But, you know, you saw, you know, Kelly and you know, just sit down and you know, over the map and Matt Lopez explaining what's going on. And you know, you saw how genuinely appreciative those guys were that somebody came out and talked to them and somebody they respected and stuff like that. So, I mean, to me, that's like the buttressing role of leaders, right, to help to be there. And I'm sure, Will, that's what you did for your company commanders. They respected you. You roll out there you know, it's that presence, right, that, hey, look, this is not going to be smooth. It's not going to be easy. It's not always going to go the way we want it to. But we're going to win, right?
Hey, here's a General Kelly story for you. Back at Pendleton, we were doing night driving training because it was division order. And we rolled over an MTVR, totaled it.
Hey, just for everybody who doesn't know, night driving is scary shit. Back in the day, I mean, our optics were not that great, and so it was green in two dimensions, right?
And we're in that Pulgas Canyon area behind Las Flores. There's no light at all. And we did this thing every week. And we rolled an MTVR. We were pretty new assets then and, you know, expensive, and destroyed it.
Explain what that is.
General Kelly comes out the next day. He looks at it. He says, "Hey, what were you doing?" "We're doing night driving training per the division order." "Yeah, how'd it go?" I said, "Well, it went the way it normally does. You know, the motor T officer comes in, we give the brief, we run a convoy this way, we run a convoy that way." He looks at it and says, "Huh. Yeah, this shit's going to happen. All right, thanks." And it was like, yeah, the guy gets it. We were actually doing what we're supposed to do to standard, and there's risk in everything that you do. And we just happen to hit that 1 to 10% risk that went catastrophic. And no one got hurt, thank God.
Right.
But the guy came out, and he didn't interrogate me, you know, in the secret police way, trying to find out what we were doing wrong. He interrogated me to find out what we had done, and figured out by doing that, we actually had done the right thing. And I take little credit. That motor T unit I had was really, really good. In fact, I used to go to this every once in a while, a little bit hyped up, and realize I got nothing to do here. These guys really got it. But that was a real lesson for me, that you don't have to find the bad guy in every incident. Sometimes shit just happens.
Yeah. That's an experienced person, though, right? Yeah. I mean, and most, hey, yeah. Most people, I think if our collective experience, most of the things we saw were bad things happen. You know, the first people that show up are, they have the prosecutorial tone to it, right? And we all know that, you know, the investigation has to happen and things like that. But it's pretty cool when a grown-up shows up as opposed to somebody who makes you feel like you're a criminal. And I will tell you this, night driving at Pendleton during the winter when the water table's a little bit high, that's scary. You get, you know, with LAVs, it doesn't take much of a slope with some moisture to get that son of a bitch to move sideways. And the problem with the LAV is, you know, guys, the immediate action drill when it gets ready to roll is to drop into the vehicle, right? But guys' instinct is to leap clear, and they always leap in the direction of the roll, and then the vehicle rolls over them. And right. So it's scary shit. You know, when people would say, "Well, you're going to the field next week. What are you doing?" And we'd say, "Winching operations." We would be fucking stuck. All the time. Anyway, Jeff, you were
saying so. Say something about EI Company.
Again. Yeah, sure.
Well, you know, for that was an accidental blessing having that. I was a weapons platoon commander because, you know, I had a lot of prior enlisted time in the grunts and everything. But I have to tell you, that job, you're seeing the young officers through the eyes of the EIs who are doing the instructing. And it's a unique perspective. You know, it really helped me later on in my career. And incidentally, Gibson, you mentioned Lieutenant Colonel Gibson and John Maloney both had that job, Weapons Platoon EI Company, before they came up to IOC. And it was, you know, like I say, it's just because you saw how the lieutenants appear through the eyes of the enlisted guys who were showing them how to do stuff, but are also watching every single thing they were doing. So it's a unique way of looking at stuff. You know,
you want to know, you know what I remember when Lenny went down there, and Will, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things he asked us to do, and I think by that time I was leaving tactics, I was going over to IRC, but he's like, "Hey, what I need you to do is, if you don't do it already, I need you to give my guys an order and treat them just like you'll treat the lieutenant platoon. All right? They're going to show up, they're going to have maps, right? They're going to have order taking material, and I need you to treat them and teach them just like you're going to teach lieutenants, okay?" Because he said, "Look, there's some great Marines down here, and we got to get them to reenlist, and there's some really great NCOs, and this is a hard job." And I mean, we were all, I mean, You know, I think those of us who loved what we did and were professionals about it, Lenny, hopefully we were already doing it, but I think all of us put more emphasis and more effort into it, and you could see how much they appreciated it, that they were being treated more like Marines, more part of the program. And then on the backside of it, if I recall right, they would come by and give us their observations at the end of the problem. How do we make it better? And then the other thing Lenny did, I think, and again, Will, correct me if I'm wrong, but he began to assign the same NCOs to the same problems, right? And well, so they helped you evolve the problem, make it better, because you weren't just renting a grunt. You were getting these guys that worked this problem and knew how to do it on a regular basis. So it increased the quality of the experience and the quality of their experience, which I think probably for Lenny was as important as increasing the overall experience for the lieutenant.
Yeah, Lenny, I think he started a lot of that stuff, and that's what I mean. He sort of grabbed them after they'd flown off the cliff and at least got them back on the cliff. It led to certain things. There was no stated main effort when I took over, and then I made the main effort at the infantry officer course, and I talked to John Allen about it and said, sir, I'm going to staff you at 100% every time. Reinforcing that same thing that while these Marines are supposed to be helping train the lieutenants, it's also very useful to have the staff train these Marines and hold them accountable for things. And so, times would come up and we'd have to have a full platoon out there. You got 220 odd Marine infantrymen, maybe 180 are effective, and you got to send 40 to the infantry officer course. So now you're down to 140 effectives, and you got two field problems going on with the basic school. And people say, well, how come I only get two guys out here? I'm supposed to have a fire team. I said, because I prioritize. Well, that ain't right. Really? Who's going to decide the priority if it's not the commanding officer?
Yeah.
And occasionally people, would bow up a little bit and attempt to get through the basic school chain of command, but no one could stand up to the reasoning. And once John Allen recognized that I was giving him support and I was getting out on the limb a little bit, he was a great advocate for that. And he said, hey, this is the premier course here. You need to have that. And he was very adept within that bureaucracy at making sure that we didn't get hung out by some bureaucrat.
And I was also
trying to pressure the basic schools. They're like, well, where are all your people? I said, who the fuck are you to ask me about that, Captain?
Yeah.
And the three of the basic school asked me one time, well, how come you got so many people on leave? I said, sir, I got 8% of the people on leave. 8%. It's 12 months. Everyone gets a month off. You got to have 8% on leave at any one time. Well, we don't do that in a fleet. And I said, I know, so there's a deployment cycle. There's not a week here that I could tell people is going to be a week of leave. Everyone go on leave. I said, yeah. And also, a lot of these guys just got back from the war where they haven't been on leave from any time in the last year. But people were, again, they just don't critically think about the resources they have and how to, use them. And it was more of a, well, I just told you to do something, do it, with no thought process at all. And John Allen was a guy that thought. And I believe that he reinforced with the staff up there, that we're supposed to be training these guys, that they help us train. And it's a virtuous circle that continues to improve as you go.
He was
one of the things I learned from him.
He would crush people at meeting, and they were afraid of him. And so when he, gentlemen, I believe that and he would wax eloquent. Most of them wouldn't say a fucking word, man. They were afraid of him. He came there following Kelly, with a big reputation, even as a major of being an outstanding officer. And very different. Kelly, a ball busting guy from Boston, and Allen, kind of a southern gentleman from
aristocrat.
Yeah, from Mac? Do you think Lincoln really meant that? Well, I don't think he said scratch his balls in public, sir, but maybe he said it. No, but I'll tell you what, I got warned when I went over there, and he was going to be the group chief. Lieutenant Colonel Bob Grider warned me, took me aside. He said, Mac, you're not going to get along with him. And I just looked at him. I said, what do you mean, sir? He said, he's not your kind of guy. He said, I'm just telling you that. I'm warning you. You just have to be careful. You probably need to rein your parade in a little bit. And I was just going over there. So my parade wasn't anything great, but I was me. And so I said, all right, sir. John Allen opened more doors for me. And we do have different, but he was absolutely fantastic to me. And this, I mean, I say this as a compliment to him as an officer, in that you didn't have to be like him for him to recognize that you had some talent and then leverage your talent.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so it was, and I remember even going over, we only kicked one lieutenant out of IOC. And
I remember that too.
Yeah, and he was fantastic in that whole thing. And we were not, you know, we weren't hating on the kid, but he just had the wrong things in his head. He shouldn't be in a position probably to be a Marine Corps officer, but that ship had already sailed. He certainly should not have been in a position, a life and death position. And yeah. We tried to articulate that, and he was fantastic at it. You know, I remember was it Bob Adelman? He was maybe the XO of the basic school at the time, Lieutenant Colonel type. And he says, so, you know, he looks at Major Allen, and I'm in there, and he says, John, can you tell us what are we going to see here? And he was wonderful. He said, you're going to see a wonderful young man who cannot make a decision under pressure. And he said, I'll let Mac recount this thing. And we did this thing called Weapons Platoon Live Fire, Whoop-Loof. And Timmy's infamous for being the machine gun guy out there. And
he's a lumberjack.
Hey,
man, I'm just clearing fields of fire, boys.
Ecological nightmare out there. But anyway, that's a different story. But one of the ways we used to build the problems was, you know, you give the lieutenants the order, right? And then slowly but surely, the assets they have, you know, you're not going to get two helos, you're going to get one. And then the helos, you know, completely cancel out 30 minutes before you're supposed to get across the line of departure. Now what do we do? Right? And so it's all choreographed, you know, to make them, you know, evolve decisions, to put pressure on them and fight to win, you know, evolve it to a win. So anyway, so this lieutenant, whose name I won't say, who I remember, he was the machine gun section leader. And the machine guns got in tracks, and they headed for their first firing position. And then they come to a surface-laid minefield, right, that has trees on both sides. So the tracks couldn't get through the trees. So this lieutenant, you know, the vehicle stops, and the sergeant says, he's in on it. He goes, sir, there's a surface-laid minefield. And this lieutenant looks at the sergeant and says, drive through it. I'll take responsibility. And the sergeant looks at him and says, sir, I'm not going to do that. That'll kill my Marines. And he says, sergeant, I'm giving you an order. And you could hear, like, the sword being unsheathed, like, whoosh, like, and you could hear bugles playing. Da, 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 right? Like, that's not what we do, okay? This is not a sword arch at a wedding, bro. This is life and death. And he had made two other decisions like that. And I finally went to Major Allen and said, sir, we can't do this anymore. This guy's got to go. And he was fantastic. But he was very compassionate. He said, look, this kid's trying as hard as he can. He just doesn't belong in this MOS. We need to get him another MOS where he can support people where he doesn't have life and death responsibility because he can't handle it. He has an older brother that was killed in a car accident, a West Point graduate in Germany. He came in following his brother's footsteps, his brother in the Army, and he in the Marine Corps. But you just saw, you know, what a good leader John Allen was.
You know, Mac, that Rother incident in 1988, if you read the investigation, every field grade officer and above had to read that investigation. But the guy that held most responsibility for that was a lieutenant who Colonel Huddleston and his crew tried to bounce out of IOC and weren't able to do it. So I think your guy, and then a couple years later, Captain Furness had a guy who he also got rid of. And the deciding thing, I think, was influenced by the Rother investigation and how that got balled up, you know?
Explain to everybody what the Rother thing is.
The Rother thing is in 1988 in the summertime, 3-2 was doing CACs, and they had road guards out to keep units, you know, within the parameters of all the surface danger zones for the live fire exercise that was going on. That was the final exercise of CACs. And this kid was left out there at in a desolate place by himself. A couple of key bad decisions made by a lieutenant who in 3-2 had been relieved of platoon commander duties, sent to the staff, then relieved his first job on the staff in the 3 shop, the operation shop, ended up in the 4 shop. They wanted to relieve him again, and the colonel there was he was the brother of, anyways, I don't go into that, but anyway, he made the decision to keep the guy, and then the guy made this other mistake, you know, a series of mistakes that resulted in Rother being abandoned out there and eventually dying out in the desert, you know, by himself. And Will and I, while that happened, we were up in Bridgeport, and the Marine Corps was in the habit of sending 2nd Marine Battalions to CACs and then straight up to Bridgeport. So those guys came up there. I don't know if you remember it, Will, but I knew a couple of them. Yeah, they came up, and we were just getting ready to go to Reno. We had finished the summer package. So I remember talking to, like, Duffy and Bob Muse, you know, Matt Duffy and Bob Muse, and they're like, we don't know. We think this guy's – and these were Boston guys. We think this guy's girlfriend went and picked him up on I-40, and, you know, he escaped basically from – but he hadn't. He had been abandoned out there because of the negligence of that lieutenant. And I think subsequent – you know, we did not bounce a lot of guys out of IOC because I think TBS did a pretty good job of winnowing, you know, that, you know, in those days. And, but that guy that you guys got rid of is one. And then the only one I know of after that was Dave Furness was the, you know, like the mentor group leader. And this guy, or maybe he was a class advisor. He said, this guy just had to go. And he was the same type of thing. He was a good Marine. He ended up as the 4 for the 15th MU when I was the 3. Wow. And he was a good 4. Right. So it was kind of awkward with him and Dave Furness, battalion commander. But he was professional. He did his job.
Right. You know? Right. No. And again, the way this stuff bubbles up is, you know, he's doing something, and Timmy would come. And Timmy, I think Timmy was probably the first person who walked up to me and said, "Hey, Mac, I've got to tell you, this guy wasn't close." You know, so yeah. and it was early in the course, and you know a lot of guys screw it up, but there's things that you can screw up where you look at it and say, no, he's fine, you know, and then there's other things that you screw up and you look at like something's wrong here, and so by the time you're doing that, you've been there and you've been training with thousands of lieutenants. I mean, and hundreds of iterations of patrols and attacks and things. And so you have a pretty good model of what it is to be within under the bell curve. Yeah. And I was the only one that I saw where we questioned whether we should graduate him. But it started with Timmy coming to me, I think. And then other captains, and they didn't like, nobody else knew that Timmy came to me to talk about the guy. Right?
Yeah.
And then it would be like Scott Sobka walks up to me and says, "Hey, Mac, you know, Scott Sobka, tough guy from New Jersey.
Great guy.
Yeah, captain type. Wasn't he a 3-8 guy, Will?
No, he was 2-8.
He was 2-8. He's in my class of Navy.
I think he was 2-4, Will.
No, he was 2-8.
No, he was 2-8.
Okay. He turned into 2-6.
Okay, yeah, that's right. Yeah, because his CO had been in Liberia. We turned over with him, Captain Rogers, who later was Colonel Rogers. But
that is the Liberia deployment of I believe the famous Buck Naked story. Yes.
No, yeah. It was the first. It was the precursor to Buck Naked. It was like,
yeah, and you know, Jeff, the reason you got to TBS, you know, was me. The reason I got to TBS was Sobka.
Yeah,
he was a friend of mine from Navy. And he talked to Grider, and that's how I got out there.
Yeah, but I remember Scott talking about Scott talked about Will, and he goes, "Hey Mac, He said, I want you to meet a friend of mine from Navy. I'm like, oh, man, come on. Really? And then Miss Congeniality walks in, right? And you're like, whoa, who's that? That's your friend? I'm like,
hey, I'll tell you, hey, you know, Sobka was the tight head prop on the A-side rugby team. He is one of the all-time tough guys.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Hey, can I say something about Weapons Soon Live Fire?
Can I say something about Scott Sobka? Scott Sobka fought a lieutenant out behind IOC one night. And we were in the Hawk. This lieutenant was a big kid. And Scott would tell these funny stories about, you know, he'd go to home to New Jersey and he'd come back. And he said, I'm paying the toll on the New Jersey Turnpike, and the guy looks at me like he's going to kick my ass. He says, you know, it just happens to me every time I go to Jersey. I'm like, are you sure? You're not a little bit? He goes, no, I know what I'm going to kick your ass looks like. And the toll, and he was like pissed about it. And
the lieutenant looked like the guy, the toll guy, or what?
Oh, I don't want to say his name. But he's a big guy, and we're in the Hawk drinking, and he says something to Scott's nickname was Yaki, for his Sobka, Yaki Soba. Somebody put that together anyway. So he says something to Yaki, and all of a sudden they leave, and they go out behind IOC and they fought. And
kicking in the gouge in the mud and the blood and the beer.
Right, and so but nothing ever got said. Nobody, there was no
good
charge sheet. I mean, back in the day. But to Will's comment, Scott Sobek was a tough kid, tough kid.
You know, Will had me do a he didn't really. We had EI company had to do a stack display for General Van Riper's old company, like right when we first got there. Remember that, Will?
And I do.
So Will puts me on it, and I'm in the armory, and these lieutenants were finishing up something. And the IOC lieutenants, and they were singing this song about Tim. It's before I even met Tim. But it was, I'm Captain Lynch, and I'm okay. I shoot down trees that get in my way. And it was a whole fucking song about Weapons to Live Fire. And I'm thinking, because they were funny. Remember, the lieutenants were funny as shit, you know? And and so then I met Tim. And the first thing we talked about, I'm thinking in my mind, I'm Captain Lynch, and I'm okay. But Tim told me about the Room of Pain. You remember that, Tim? We're up there, and
I don't remember the first time we met. I just remember how much fun it was to be out there with you, because I would write down some of the shit you would say and use it in class. Because until you showed up, nobody knew who you were. But you were friggin' awesome for quips and funny quotes and stuff like that. I gotta defend myself on this Rage 7 treatment.
First Lieutenant Jeff Kenny.
Yes.
We heard about
it. He looked like one of the EI sergeants. It was hard to pick him out at first until you started talking.
It was a really hard sales job for me until people got to know him, because they'd take one look at him and say, no way.
He looked like a sergeant. He looked like a sniper.
With his crooked glasses.
But goddamn, was he funny. He'd come up and start talking to you. He'd have me and Paul Kennedy in stitches.
Oh,
you know?
Kennedy.
I'm writing shit down this
Kennedy, party. Who was my sidekick there,
yeah.
He met Jeff before I did, and he's telling me, he goes, hey, buddy, you got to meet this guy, Kenny. I'm like, who is it? He's a weapons platoon down at EI company. He's an awesome guy, and he's funny as hell, and he's smart. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. And I said, well, how did he get out here? And he said, Will brought him out. And so, you know, one of the things you learn in the Marine Corps is people run in packs, right? They run in packs. If like if you meet us, it's like, do you know this guy? Do you know this guy? Yes, yes, yes. It's like, how do these guys all know each other? And it's the way it works. You earn your way into that. And it's probably the coolest tribe you could ever join in the Marine Corps. But Jeff, Lieutenant Kenny, he shows up. And no, but he's a good leader, and he knew his shit. And he always, and this is the thing about us that, I mean, you hear it even today. We were all learners, man. Yeah. You know, Tim talking about listening to Jeff and writing down stuff Jeff says to use in his classes and stuff. And
absolutely.
And we used to do that all the time, and this is really an extension of that, this continuing a discussion mm-hmm. that started 30 years ago.
It is.
The let's talk about New Year's. COVID New Year's. Any big plans, Jeff? Since that's an opinion, question, you have to go first.
I know. I'm gonna hunker down like a jackass in the rain in my house, like a chicken shit COVID guy that I am. I'm so sick of this stuff. But you know, and I have to tell you, Orange County mostly is rebelling against the governor, as you know, Matt.
Oh my God, it's hilarious, man! You go down Del Mar Street in San Clemente, and everybody's like, serving food outside. I'm like, what the hell?
I know. Yeah,
it's like, awesome.
So yeah, we're just staying home. I just got back from Colorado, seeing my kids out there. And I'll tell you what, I got a snow appreciation day the last day I was there, man. Took me and my youngest kid like 25 minutes to get his vehicle, just all the snow and ice off it, just so we can go to the airport. So, but anyway, yeah, I'm not doing much.
All right. Timmy, how about you? What's going on on the border?
Oh, on the border, we've got serious winter weather here. It's about 46 degrees and rainy, and that would drive the locals indoors for quite some time. That's like traumatic to them. But no, nothing much is going on. And I was going to watch football tomorrow because I haven't watched it most of the year. I watched one game, and that one game was Notre Dame Clemson. And now Notre Dame is playing in the championship round, and they look like absolute garbage. Right. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know what's going on here? Fucking Notre Dame's going to win. It's fixed, just like the election. That's the way I'm thinking about things right now. How else do you explain Notre Dame being number four in the country? Although I wouldn't know because I haven't watched all season.
I'll explain it to you. They were 10-0. They beat Clemson the first time. Clemson was short a few players. Clemson kicked their ass the second time.
Yeah,
and so I'm a Notre Dame fan. But I believe that Alabama's going to bring, lay the fucking
wood. No. Put your money on them. Put your money on them. Yeah.
Listen to this. All right. The little engine that could, we're going to get that going. Nice.
Can I add a
You sound like my cousin Tom. No, they're going to win, Mike. Tom, what intellectual right premise do you hang that thread of hope on? Okay.
A fixed game. That's what.
Exactly.
A fixed game.
Exactly. We need to get, if we got the Italian Catholics involved in it, then we might have a chance, all right? So, but until then, not so much. Will, what about you? I'm going to watch that game, though.
Oh, yeah, it'd be a good game.
Yeah, I don't know if it will. Hopefully.
Since I crossed the border, I'm supposed to be self-quarantining. But I was looking for fun, I would get a BMW and drive it down around Times Square and see if I could attract some attention.
Hey, how about the explosion in Nashville, man?
So what do you think, Matt? What do you think that's all about?
I think it's like spooky stuff, right? I think it's like, I don't know, like I've read a whole bunch of crazy stuff about it, but to me, let me ask you this. So you're a local police person. She calls police and says he's making bombs in his Winnebago. They supposedly go out, knock on his door. He doesn't answer. They see cameras, multiple, that are wired to watch the Winnebago, right? And then they leave. The FBI runs his data and says, yeah, he's not on our radar. And so that's the end of the report. That's all they did. Yeah. Like, are you fucking kidding me? It's like that kid. It reminded me of that kid in Florida that went to high school and killed a bunch of kids, right?
Hey,
50, wait a 50 second. Times? 50 times police responded to calls about that kid?
Yeah.
And you can't. And then somebody tipped the FBI off, right? That he, that he's making threats and he's got a rifle, and the FBI fucked that one up. I mean, if you can't stop, in my opinion, easy shit like this, so it's like probable cause. His girlfriend called police and said he's an eyewitness. He's making bombs, and they didn't even interview him. And you're like, I hope there's more to this story, because fuck, man. I mean, you look at that explosion, and but for the grace of God, nobody gets killed in downtown Nashville. How the fuck does that even happen?
Yeah.
In 2002, in Lee Summit, Missouri, Me and my team flew in to set up this multi-huge exercise, which started on a Sunday, was going to go Monday with at a venue where we concurrently did the bomb and the hostage and the chemical release. But we made a chemical reduction. We made a reaction lab. We were making basically sarin, a derivative, not sarin, but a chemical compound with similar capabilities that we used as a testing agent. We built it in the Home Depot parking lot. I mean, out in the open with these. You can look in this thing and see, hey, that's a big fucking chemical laboratory. I thought for sure at least the cops would come and say, think we're making crack or something. I mean, it was venting off shit on the top. But we made this shit in a parking lot and nobody said a word to us. That was part of our debrief. We're like, you know, this is kind of weird. This is the kind of stuff you should not expect to see. And therefore, rule of opposites, you should notify the cops. But nobody said a damn thing. It was the most, I was amazed that we got away with it.
Well, again, if you can't prevent the ones that you know about, and I differentiate the intel about that when you got an eyewitness who's telling you that from like post 9/11 retrospective analysis that says, hey, you know, in a stack of 2,000 reports, somebody who had never reported before said this, and it was, you know, stray voltage. Well, yeah, in retrospect, that's kind of, you know, 2020. That's not the way intel works. Uncorroborated first time.
Too busy busting restaurant owners who had the temerity to stay open.
Exactly. Exactly. But this is different, and it's like that makes me not feel good, because I believe you're going to see more and more and more of this as a frustrated nation who doesn't believe in the election system anymore, who looks at the media as crooked, who looks at big tech as enabling more crooked shit, as more people get frustrated. And we saw it, again, but for the grace of God, 35 congressmen at a baseball practice would have got smoked inside of a cage, but the dumbass tries to get inside the third base gate and they see him, which gives the Capitol Police time to react. Were it not for that, that guy was a liberal too. He was pissed. Yeah. And so, so it's like the wackos among us, you can't keep getting crazier and crazier and not expect them to go boom at some point. And literally they are. And I expect to see more of this. Let's have a little vote on that. Jeffrey, do you expect to see more of that?
Well, you're describing me when you're going through your little thing there. Yeah, so that's pretty much me now, Jeff King. But I do. And I have to tell you, though, I sense a disturbing disturbing complacency in the population across America. I mean, the only ones who get pissed and act out are the ones who have nothing to be pissed about and nothing to act out about, these BLM and Antifa folks. But now there's been ample reason for armed, as Sean Connery would say, for armed resistance, you know, and yet nothing happens. I'm not saying I'm going to, you know, do that, or I don't want to, you know, suggest something like that, but you're not seeing any kind of, reaction to the stuff that you just listed. You know, it's just kind of like everybody's kind of like, oh, well, gee, oh, well. And then the other disturbing thing is that the conservative party, half of them are pretending that the election was, you know, and all this other stuff that's happened in the last 4 years has all been, you know, nothing to really worry about. But it's a huge thing to worry about.
Got it. Tim, your thoughts. So we're going to see more of this?
I think we're going to see more of it. I think we're going to see it coming from our side. And I'm going to tag team with what Jeff said, because we've talked about how the media, Hollywood, academia, all the big forces seem to be against people with our views, which I would describe as just traditional Americans who believe that this is a great country and worthy of our defense and our allegiance. But that the propaganda we're being fed by the mainstream media, they're not trying to inform or convert us. They're trying to humiliate us. Remember the gigantic backlash to Obama's first term was reflected by the creation of the Tea Party. I wasn't here. I spent all that time in Afghanistan, but I do remember that Tea Party thing was gaining momentum right up until the time that Bill Maher started calling them tea baggers. And after the left and the media were able to start ridiculing them and humiliating them with that tea bagger label, it basically kind of just drifted away. I think you're going to see a resurgence of it. And I think that as part of that resurgence, you're going to see people standing up for their basic rights in the form of protesting these lockdowns, because it sounds like Bo Jiden's going to, Fauci's talking about, we got to stay at this for another year and a half or so until everybody's gotten the vaccine twice, that's a whole different story. So I think we're going to continue to see this bullshit over the COVID, and we're going to continue to be humiliated by the mainstream media people like us. And I think at some point we're going to see people pushing back, starting with people keeping bars open and stuff like that. Well, hell, that bar owner in Queens already hit the sheriff that was trying to arrest him again. Yeah, and broke both his legs. So you've already seen it start. I think this bombing down in Nashville could potentially be something, because apparently it was right next to the building where all the terminus for all the fiber optics AT&T runs is. Right. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Maybe the guy that they say did it, maybe the guy that they say did it is Richard Jewell. I don't know what to believe anymore. Right. I just know that I don't, I just know that that everything right now I just take with a grain of salt, and I just refuse to be humiliated and depressed. That's the only thing I can do.
Will, we're going to see more of this?
Yeah, I think we're going to see more of it. You know, a couple of days ago when I drove up here through Pennsylvania, you see on these big highway signs, Pennsylvania COVID regulations, for out-of-state self-quarantine or negative test. It was absolutely infuriating to me. There's a different vibe in different parts of the country. I think that in the metropolitan East in particular, people are more used to a lot of this sort of fascism. And I don't think that their representatives recognize how infuriating it is to sort of freedom-loving people in the rest of the country. When people got nothing left to lose, you're in a bad spot, right?
Yeah.
And again, that video of the guy driving the BMW yesterday.
How does he just
that guy?
Yeah, how does he just sit? How does he just sit
Houston
there throughout all that?
Or Kansas City, and there's gunfire.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I tell you how he does that, Mac. It's not fight or flight, as you know from the Room of Pain. It's fight, flight, submit or posture. That guy submitted. It's the most common reaction for the defenseless humans. It's the most common reaction to people who are incapable of defending themselves is to submit. Total submission instantly. That's what that was. Exactly,
you watch
what
it and it's like, dude, just throw it in gear, right, and drive out
run
of
them
there.
Over. Yeah.
Well, you don't have to run them over, but drive for your own safety. You have the right to, you know, you have the right to be safe. But there was one other thing I was going to ask you, and it was a derivative of I know what I was going to say. The progression of this, I've been extremely critical of, you know, and I don't want to get into a discussion about whether COVID is real or not, but the discussion I have in my head is, as an elected official that is making public policy, you have the data that tells you, right, this is all going to get worse in the winter. Yet we saw no preparation for it. You saw no surge capacity at all. And now we're talking about sailing those two ships again. Well, I mean, so we're in the OPT this summer talking about the winter, right? And we don't say, okay, look, we're going to ask the state to mobilize their hospital tents, you know, the ones that we lived in, and we're going to use those as our general occupancy beds. You know, it'll be in this parking lot. That'll free up the second and third floors to become, right, level one ICU units. And then we'll have level two units that are normal ICU units. So we'll expand our ICU capability. And it's like, so we will do that all in preparation for this thing, because every virus that comes to the country gets worse in the winter. And you virtually saw none of that, because the card that was going to play was going to be shut everything down.
Yeah,
and so I find it just just this colossal public policy failure to say, look, we can't keep this shut down, because as the governor, Will and I were talking about this a day or two ago, about, so you have all these apartment properties and nobody's paying rent, or very few people are paying rent in them right now. And the state has told me that I can't evict you. Is the state going to compensate me for what I was not paid? Answer, fuck no, they're not.
That could drive people to armed resistance right there.
Well, and so the evictions, I can't evict people. You can't compensate me. The bank's going to foreclose on me. Are you going to rescue me, the bank, the rent owner? Nobody? And so did you not think this through? Did you not have your guy on the economic council sitting in there with the public health person that says, I think we should shut it down, right? And the economic guy go, yeah, we can't do that. We simply cannot do that. Because if we, you know, and so I'm looking at this thinking, okay, right, as a public policy, as a politician, a governor, a mayor, I didn't see anybody do anything. I didn't read a story about, hey, in Missouri, they have this robust preparation for this winter because they know that the virus is probably going to surpass what it did in the spring, and they're going to be ready for it because the thing they're not going to do is shut down the state. I didn't see that. I didn't see, and Will made this point to me the other day, you know, what percentage of death is senior citizen, people over the age of 65, right?
80%.
Yeah, 80%. I didn't see 80% going to fortify the conditions that those people live in.
Yeah,
I didn't see that. You know, so, in terms of public policy, what the fuck, man?
Look at the implications, Will. Look at the implications, Mac. If they can do this, based on this disease that 99.6% of people got, you know, that chance of surviving, you know, without any after effects, 99.6. If that's the case, they'll just gin up another emergency next year over global warming. You know, some phonies,
I don't think they can, because let me tell you,
What's to stop them?
When the bill hits Main Street,
yeah,
this shit's over. And so far,
let me ask a question.
When the money ain't there, and it's not there, and you're not going to be able to compensate, right, landlords who then can't pay the bank, I mean, what the fuck happens? Yeah, then what happens?
Well, it's like, what happens when you can't afford Obamacare? Everyone says, finally, they throw up their hands and they go to single payer. That was the goal all along, was to get to single payer. That's the in other words, basically force us to pay taxes for stuff we don't want.
Okay, Will's got to take off. So, final comment, Will, or what are you reading? Take your pick.
I finished the book Apocalypse Never. I recommend everybody read it. It's a very footnoted book about the hysteria around all things environmental. And it's written by an environmental wacko. And so now I'm reading Sparta's Second Attic War by Paul Rahi. I read Sparta's First Attic War a couple of weeks ago. Just a really good writer and a really good topic. And a lot of it relates to how nations interplay even today. So just very well done.
Got it. All right, Will. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, gentlemen.
Yeah, Happy New Year, buddy.
All right. Tim, how about you? What you're reading? Final thought?
I was just going to give one final thought, and that is that I have not been able to find any reliable statistics as to how many people are behind on their rent or not paying, how many are behind their mortgage. But I've seen some. I've seen some quotes in opinion pieces that are like 60%, or it's millions. I mean, I don't even know how big that problem is, and it's not something we can expect the press to be honest with us about.
Well, and you know what's interesting about that? Okay, so all the bar business, where did those people go?
Yeah, I know a bunch of
All the restaurant business, where did those people go? Did those guys just magically go to Amazon? And speaking of Amazon, I had a Marine email me on December 26th who was struggling. And he flew out here yesterday. A friend said, "Hey, come out here, and I can help you get a job." And so I got a chance to meet him yesterday. So he calls me 2 days ago, and he said, "Hey, Matt, can I ask you a favor?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Could you pick me up at LAX and take me to Riverside?" And you know, my first instinct was to say, "No, come on, Matt, Riverside." Yeah. But I thought, you know what? Why the fuck not? And I said, so send me the address. So he sends it to me. It's in fucking Beaumont, not Riverside. Yeah, Beaumont is like halfway to Las Vegas, okay?
Yeah.
It's no, Beaumont is like 6 miles from Palm Springs.
It's on the road to 29 Palm.
Exactly. So tell me I am not going straight to fucking heaven, right? Picking a Marine up at LA, former Marine up at LAX, 3-5 guy, right? And taking him to fucking Beaumont for a job interview. And then he was, you know, and then he's going to go live with his buddy.
Yeah.
Right? St. Peter's going to see me and he'd look at me and go, Mac, all this other stuff, I'm going to forgive for your Beaumont trip. I'm like, thanks, St. Peter.
That's a hell of a town, Beaumont, though. I mean, you should have got a hotel and party that.
Beaumont, let me just tell you about Beaumont. Beaumont is where, right, you could get in a bar fight with a pool cue, right, as Marines often do, and it's legitimate defense to say, oh, the reason I hit him with a pool cue? He tried to leapfrog his quarter on the jukebox over me.
Yeah.
And
it looked at me dirty, like in the New Jersey
right
toll guys.
And people would look at it. People would look at you and say, "That's legit." Got it. All right, no charges filed. But yeah, speaking of Amazon, that's where he went for his job interview. So yeah, express ticket to heaven for me.
And real quick, another observation. Just yesterday, this was printed by Brookings Institute. Listen to the title of this article. Amazon and Walmart have raked in billions in additional profits during the pandemic and shared almost none of it with their workers. This is Brookings Institute. This is a big article, too. Do you believe that shit?
John.
Now, what the hell's going on there?
John Rutherford Allen.
Yeah.
Rutherford in his own damn self.
Yeah, well and
so John, the Earl of Rutherford.
And
hey, you want to know what one of the low points of Scott Sobka's life happened in my backyard in Quantico?
I know exactly what happened. Rutherford tagged him over the freaking roof of the house.
Yeah, we're playing wiffle ball in my backyard. The IOC staff is right, and John Allen gets up at the plate. He's a right-handed hitter, and I don't know in terms of the laws of physics and human anatomy how he did this, but his elbows in his batting stance were above his shoulders. Now, try to do that. It's impossible. So I'm out. I'm playing in the outfield. Sovka's pitching for our team.
An alien. That sounds good.
Yeah. And so I'm watching this going, clearly he didn't spend a lot of time at the park playing baseball, right?
Yeah.
And so Scott's pitching. And Scott's an athlete, right? He's a football player. He's a rugby player. He's a baseball player. He's an athlete, right?
Yeah.
He throws a pitch, and Rutherford, Major Allen, later to become General Allen, he hits it over the fucking house. And the best part was that it genuinely bothered, right?
Yeah.
Genuinely bothered Sobka.
What are you talking about, man? You started adjusting the foul line. We almost got in a fist fight at that goddamn wiffle ball game. The Wives were appalled.
That's how you play wiffle ball, right? And you're adjusting the foul line as the ball's curving for it.
Oh, yeah. I've never been so pissed off. My wife was furious with me because I wanted to
General
hit it.
General Allen employed the triangle of death. That's how he hit that ball in me. It was mine.
Oh. Sobka was – no, if you ask him about it today – he would tell you, like, yeah, that was one of the low parts of my life. I'm not going to lie to you.
That's because you all stacked the teams. Me and Graydon, and we'll put the whooping on you.
Graydon, God rest his soul, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
God rest his soul. All right, Timmy, let me let you finish your thought.
Okay, book. I got taken to the cleaners. I picked up a book called Bloody Mohawk by Richard Burlerth because it sounded like the guy's like, I always wanted to know about New York and the 100 years of fighting the Mohawks before we even get to the Revolutionary War. So right. I'm like, this would be cool. This would be sort of like maybe the Comanche book. But the goddamn guy's as a history professor at Syracuse. He starts with the racist Irish, Scotch-Irish borderers and the generous Mohawk people who accepted all creeds and all colors. And all they wanted to do was share. I read three pages and threw the god. I would have thrown the book, but it was in my Kindle, so I can't throw it. I'm like, god damn it!
Yeah,
I got tickets. I'm not going to read crap. It's more revisionist history, and I'm just upset at how much of that kind of stuff comes out. But
yeah,
so I got nothing good for the books, but just one to avoid.
Got it. All right. Yeah. Jeffrey, final word in a book.
Well, I said enough words, so but I'll talk about the books. I I'm reading, based on Timmy's recommendation, I'm reading the book by Derbingle himself.
Oh.
The Last Platoon.
Hey, let me tell you, everybody that I've spoken to echoes Tim Lynch's review.
Yeah. Which Dang West should have always been a fiction writer.
Maybe he always was.
Yeah. He says, I'm going to take this idea called The Life of the Men of 1-5 in 1966 and turn it into into something else, using it as loosely. But if he had just said that, the personal peak I have in him, he actually slandered one of my team leaders out there, because, in the whole Ganjigal thing. And then later on, it made him look dumb. And that the book, the investigation that came out on the thing totally exonerated the team leader. But all that aside, that book is a masterful fiction construction. I'm about 15 pages in. I just got it when I was in Colorado and flying back, but it is good, and I'm reading it both with an eye. Like I read Ernest Hemingway, to this day I'm still reading him, but now I look at it kind of like a clinical way of how does this guy write like this. And there's other writers too where I enjoy what they're saying, but now I'm reading it to see how they did it. You know what I mean? And
it's interesting. That's how I'm reading Vaughanot, right? And
yeah,
so right. The woman who's co-writing my book with me, she was asking me, are you a science fiction guy? And I'm like, come on. Do I sound like a dork? She's like, I knew. She's like, damn it. And I'm like, she said, I knew you wouldn't be. And I said, yeah, I'm not. And she said, how do you say his name, Jeff? I'm pronouncing it wrong.
Vonnegut. Kurt Vonnegut.
Vonnegut writes essentially his story, right, in Slaughterhouse 5. But he uses fiction, which allows him much more latitude as a writer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so she says, I would like you to listen to it or read it, because I think that your book would be better done like that, in that mode, the way Vaughanot does it. And I said, okay. So I've been and I'm fascinated by storytelling because it's what I do, right? I mean, post-traumatic winning is essentially taking people on a journey to show them that there is a path through the valley of the shadow of death. And I will tell you this, just that powerful visual image, right, that I happened upon by accident takes me to creating a slide and beginning to use that as, instead of just saying, when life pushes you into darkness, I say, and I throw up the 23rd Psalm and I say, you've all seen this. You don't see the last phrase in it, thy rod and thy staff comfort me. I said, so David doesn't go down there with a bottle of pills and a rabbit's foot, right? He goes down there armed to fight his way out of the valley of the shadow of death. And so look at post-traumatic winning as the armory at the entrance to the valley. Right. And then So what I'm trying to do is chunk this pregnant thought into a powerful visual image so they don't forget it. Right.
Yep.
And so the first fucking time I do it, a Marine walks up, rolls up his sleeve, shows me a psalm, a tattoo of the 23rd Psalm on his forearm. I look at him and say, holy shit, man, I was talking to you. And he just shakes his head. Mm-hmm. And then I said, you were meant to be here. And he looks at me and he says, can I talk to you? And I said, sure. And listen to this. So his name is, I can't say his name. Anyway, but I say his name right. And it's a two-letter name. And he told me later, he said, well, the reason I kind of struck up a conversation is that you said my name right. And I said, it's two letters. How do we fuck that up? And I said, oh, never mind. It's not like phonics is our strong suit as Marines. And he starts laughing. He goes, sir, you won't believe it. So we walk over to the side, and he looks at me. He said, I was going to kill myself after Christmas, but I'm not because of what I heard today.
Yeah, there you go.
You know what I'm saying? So these things and the art of storytelling and doing it in a vibrant way, the way the kid who flew out, the way he emails me the day after Christmas. And one of his friends who saw post-traumatic winning with 3-5 emails him and say, you've got to get in touch with this dude, man. What he does is amazing. And so when he calls me, and I said, so, you know, why did you call me? He said, well, my friend told me I should. I said, has your friend ever said anything good about anything relative to mental health training? And he starts laughing. He goes, fuck no, sir. And that's why I called you, because he was dead serious with me when we spoke. You've got to. And I said, okay. And so, I mean, you know, these powerful images that show people that, you know, these things, I think, come from the art of storytelling. And that when you can make it vibrant for them, when you can make it, you know, powerful for them, not only will you change their lives as Marines or as anybody, but then they change other people's lives. And that's what, I mean, fuck. I told my kids, this is probably the best Christmas I've ever had because of these experiences. Crazy.
Well, that's awesome, brother.
Well, I mean, it's not. You guys have been a part of it, and you guys do it. And, you know, I know, Timmy, you're doing it with your guys down there, and Jeff's helped, and Jeff contributes.
Yeah,
I use Jeff's story in terms of adverse childhood experiences. Jeff tells this really funny story about a critique. Jeff, tell the story. You don't need to use the names or anything, but the AAR you were doing up near the Holf, and when the guy, the gunny, you said, hey, gunny, you got any comments?
Oh, yeah. No, we're up there. Yeah, Horno Combat.
Okay, so let me set the scene. I'm talking about adverse childhood events and how they fracture infrastructure, and then we attract tough kids in big numbers. Well, why do you become tough? Well, for most people, it's not because they just want to be tough. It's because either you're going to be tough, or life is going to kick your ass, right. And so you become tough, and that's how we. And then they look for a service. And the Marine Corps naturally is a draw to them because tough guy service. So anyway, Jeff says to me, he goes, hey, let me tell you a story, Mac. And he'll tell the story in a second. And he says, let me tell you how right you are. Okay. And then this is the story. The story is hilarious.
Yeah. So we're up there and we're teaching guys from 3-1 how to do building partner capacity. In other words, how to use interpreters and your own men to train other services from different countries and cultures. And so they do it, you know, and there's a lot of lecture demonstration. You have to be, you're using an interpreter for the first time, so there's a certain ways that are affected to do it, and they get, you know, it's not rocket science, but you got to practice it, right? So they get done, we got all the you know, the Marines from I think it was Kilo 3-1, they're all standing there, and we get ready to, we go through their what they saw, what they did. You know how we did in IOC. Right. And I'm usually the last guy to talk. So I said, and Glenn Baker, I don't know if you, he was one of Furness's lieutenants back in 2003 to 2007. He's, you know, he's there. He didn't have any comments to make. And I said, okay, Gunny, you got anything? The Gunny was there. And the Gunny, he's a recon guy, but he's not your typical macho Rico, pretty smart guy. And, you know, he says, okay, all right, gents, who here was sexually abused as a child? And I'm like, whoa, whoa. Well, we're talking about using interpreters here, you know? I mean, let's say that. And same thing with Baker. He's the turn crow. He's the OIC, right? So we're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And then I look out, I look over my eye, I see movement. I look over, 2/3 of them got their fucking hands up. I'm like, I stand there, my mouth open. I go, well, clearly, there's discussion needed here, but let's just talk about how the exercise went first. And I was shocked. I'm like, holy shit, this is on their minds, man. And I'm not talking like hesitating, you know what I mean? Like, let me see if, no, oh, you know, 2/3 hands up right away. Like, you know, who wants an extra day of liberty? Hands up, right? Same type of shit. No hesitation. I'm like, it's a different. These are different bunch than the guys I came in with in 1975. You know? But yeah, so that was what happened. Right?
No, and so Jeff and I are talking, and so he said, "Look, I was stunned like 3 times in that short span of time." He said, "So I'm sitting there," and he said, "I think he told me." He said, "So you know," and I'm taking notes. And so Gunny could talk, so I'm like, and all of a sudden he says that, and then Jeff always makes his face like, ah, and it's a funny face, right? You're like, ah, he said, and I'm like, hey, shut the fuck up, up, right? Like, whoa, 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 whoa. And then I'm like,
it was a horse that got away.
Right. And then he says, I see all these hands up in the air, right? It's like, hey, put your fucking hands down. What are we doing? What are we doing here? And then, but, I mean, this is what I love about my friends, you know, the profound nature of the experience, and that when we talk about the widespread existence of this, especially in the Marine Corps, and their fucking desire to talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been living with this shit. They joined the Marine Corps to meet leaders that could help them and become better people. And that's why most of these kids are fucking miracles, man. I mean, this kid who I met who said he was going to kill himself after Christmas, he's from Burma. His family was chased out of Burma by another tribe, right, as that tribe tried to kill his tribe. He comes here as a refugee. They moved from Burma to St. Paul, for fuck's sake. Right? And he's in the Marine Corps. And I looked at him and I said, dude, you're a fucking miracle. Do you not see that? You don't belong. There's no fucking way you get here. And they don't realize that. They don't realize that. And that's the first thing that some of these kids have to realize is, dude, you don't even belong here. The only reason you're here is because of your own DNA. And then you build on that. And I'll tell you what, and they are tough kids, even in this culture. They are tough kids. And I'll tell you what, if you look at them and you can tell them you're a miracle standing here today because you don't fucking belong here. And this path exists. And if fucking Jeff Kenny can do it, if that fucking monkey could do it, like typical Marine Corps shit, any reason you can't do it? And guys look at you and like, fuck no. I mean, if that ape can do it, I can fucking do it. And that's how Marines figure shit out, right?
Yep.
But you've got to show them the path. And that's been the beautiful part of post-traumatic winning. And even as shitty as 2020 has been, it's been a wonderful year in terms of my experiences with different people. And you guys all contribute to it. But I love Jeff's story, right?
Denny TJ.
Yeah. How funny.
Won't say his whole name, but yeah.
All right. First of all, guys, Happy New Year. And this is only supposed to go 45 minutes, but we have a problem like this. and we'll go to our graves with it. So it's one of the better parts of my life. So anyway, boys, Merry.
Hodafe 2020.
There you go.
Hello, 2021.
Hey, man, I really appreciate you having us on every week, Mac. This is a hell of a lot of fun. I look forward to it. It's a big deal, and I do appreciate it.
Well, you know what? A lot of our friends listen to it, and they say the same thing. It's one of the best like commutes I have because, you know, whether I'm learning stuff or like pissing my pants laughing at you idiots. Right, yeah. It's either way, I'm good with it. And this is from Libby. Thank you, Mensa sisters, for the entertainment while I take down my Christmas decorations. Happy New Year, y'all. Libby. All right, boys. Have a great one.
Yep.
You too, brother.
All right, see you.
See you later, Timmy. Hoorah.
All right, man. Happy New Year, brother.
Hoorah. There you have it. That'll do it on a what the fuck day is it today? Thursday. That's what day it is. Yeah, that's a little potpourri for you right there. So starting with me starting the program 5 minutes late after Libby yelled at me. Then going from there. But have a great New Year's, you know. I would normally tell you to be careful, but I don't think anybody's fucking going anywhere, so I don't think I need to do that. You know, but again, I would just tell you, a lot of people out there that are hurting, whether it be financial or personally, keep your ears open, and don't be afraid to stick your hand out and say, hey, man, can I talk to you? And then, because I will tell you what, people are looking for it, and you can be that person for them. And in fact, as we were driving to, Beaumont yesterday, this guy, his first name's Edgar. Edgar looks at me and he says, "What's it feel like when you do this?" And I said, "Well, you're gonna find out." I said, "But there's no drug like it in the world." I looked at him and I said, "Why the fuck do you think I'm driving from Orange County to LAX to Beaumont?" And he starts laughing. And then he looks at me and goes, "I didn't realize Beaumont was so far from Riverside." And I'm like, "Yeah, motherfucker. And I said, but why would I do that? Because I know how it's going to make me feel. And I said, and you're going to get in the same business, right? You got to get yourself right first, and then you're going to start saving people. And so again, I can't encourage people enough to do that. And so have a great New Year's on a Thursday, All Marine Radio, for the last time in 2020. Out.